Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President-elect Donald Trump named his Homeland Security Advisor today. He's chosen cyber expert Tom Bossert. Bossert is currently a fellow at the Atlantic Council and was a former national security aide to President George W. Bush. If the events of 2016 tell us anything, Bossert will likely have a lot on his plate when he takes the job. Joining us to look at some of the big cybersecurity news this past year and what news will continue to resonate in the year ahead is Bruce Schneier, a security analyst and fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Bruce, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first, what do we know about Tom Bossert and the role of Homeland Security Advisor?
Yeah, it seems pretty informal. I actually don't know him. I looked him up. He seems okay. And I looked up who our current Homeland Security Advisor is, and there is one, and I forget the woman's name. So that should tell you that this is an informal role that hasn't been in the press much. You know, I'm going to assume it's going to advise the president on these issues, but more, I don't know. And we know this about presidential advisors, that their stature in the administration depends a lot on personalities and a little less on job titles. So a lot of this is let's wait and see.
Okay, so let's move on to some of the big cyber stories of 2016. First, the reports of hacking in the U.S. presidential election. Now, we know that Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton recently said that Russian hackers went after her campaign because Russian President Vladimir Putin had a personal grudge against her. And then in a wide-ranging press conference last week, Putin said Democrats in Washington are trying to shift blame for their failures in the election. What do we take from all of this about Russia's involvement in this election? What's the main message here?
The main message is when it gets political, it's really hard to do good computer security. Russians didn't hack the elections, and that thing is a bad phrase because when we hear that, we think of hacking the voting machines. And although there was some talk about Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, there's no evidence that the vote was hacked, that the machines were hacked, that there was anything other than accurate counting of the vote. Now, there certainly was Russian interference in the election process. We've known that for months. We've been talking about that for months, and that is the hacking of the DNC and other computers, servers, and the release of information. And that's a very different sort of campaign. This is scary. This is foreign influence on our elections. Now, this isn't a new thing. The U.S. did this in Latin America for decades. I mean, it's just new tactics. And it is worrisome because it's very hard to investigate it when it's partisan. So think about a couple of years ago when North Korea attacked Sony. That was big news, but it didn't involve politics, so it could be big news easily. This involves politics. Now suddenly you have congressmen and senators and individuals taking sides depending on who they wanted to be president, and now we have a lot of trouble doing a real investigation. And this is going to be dangerous going forward because the last thing we want is to give the message, which we did, that if you can get away with it for a couple of days after the election, you're going to get away scot-free.
Hmm. What about the connection with WikiLeaks here, which released some of the DNC emails? What do we know about that?
So WikiLeaks publishes stuff they receive.
But not the Republican National Committee emails.
They publish what they receive. They publish everything they receive. Hmm. So WikiLeaks is, in a sense, a tactic. The hackers who attack the DNC use WikiLeaks. If WikiLeaks didn't exist, they would have used half a dozen other mechanisms for publishing. So I wouldn't focus on WikiLeaks because they just happened to be there. Mm-hmm. They weren't essential in the process.
Now, you say there was no evidence about voting machines being tampered with, and yet you've written about your concerns about voting machines. Why is that?
I mean, voting machines are vulnerable, and they will be hacked sooner or later. In this election, they seem to have not been. Doesn't mean they're secure. And I worry about this, you know, for a really important reason. If you think about elections, they serve two purposes. The first one is the obvious one, to choose the winner. And the second is to convince the loser that he lost fairly. Mm-hmm. That hacking, allegations of hacking, are enough to throw election results in turmoil. Now, we in the United States are generally better than that. You know, we've certainly had our problems. But you think about other countries which have more tenuous holds on democracy, a tainted election could easily delegitimize the entire process. So the integrity of the system is vital for the integrity of the process.
Mm-hmm. What do you think may have been motivation to raise questions about the integrity of the American process?
Well, you know, that it certainly depends. If you are a foreign country, you might want one of the other candidates to win. I mean, certainly when the United States interferes in elections, that's why we do it. Right? We want one candidate to win. You could just want to put a monkey wrench into the process. Right? You want to mess things up. I mean, there's as many motivations as there are people who want to do this. And interfering in an election, it's not hard to come up with reasons why a person, a country, an organization might want to do it.
What do you think needs to be done to protect the integrity of voting machines? Can we do it?
So I think we can. We have to fall back onto machines we know work. Now, the correct machine is an optical scan machine. My legal residence is Minnesota, and I know we use these machines. I'm not sure what we use in Massachusetts. And this is a piece of paper you vote on. You fill in ovals. That paper is fed into a machine which reads your vote, automatically tabulates it, but stores that paper. And the key is a voter verifiable paper ballot. And if we do that, we can much, much more effectively ensure the integrity of the voting process. Right? This is not speaking of the networks of the candidates and all everything that's coming before, but that's what we need to do. These touchscreen machines are very vulnerable, the computerized machines. So it's really moving back to more secure, less automated technology. And I would like to see a permanent bureaucracy in charge of the vote in the United States. Other countries have this. You know, we have a very ad hoc partisan system, and that just makes it harder to deal with things that come up. Because if you think about it, 2 weeks before the election, it's easy to come up with rules about what to do in case of problems, because no one knows who the problems will fall on. It's just after the fact, the battle lines are drawn, and you can't step back and figure out the right thing to do. So more planning, better voting machines. You know, we really do need to secure candidate networks. Now, in a lot of ways, politics is propaganda, right? It's my message versus your message. So it's almost hard to stop foreign interference, because what's the difference? And one side will welcome it because it'll be on their side. But I want us to do better at trying to keep our elections inside our borders. I don't think the country is served well if foreign powers can put the finger on the scales in any direction.
So I want to talk about more automated here and the so-called Internet of Things. You testified before Congress about this. Explain just very briefly what that is exactly.
So the Internet of Things is a term we use for all those computerized everythings we're getting. Right, so your smartphone. I have a internet-enabled thermostat. If you have a new refrigerator or a television or a baby monitor, many of these are on the internet. And more things are becoming computerized. You can buy an internet-enabled Barbie doll. You can buy an internet-enabled coffee machine. And you might wonder why you might want one of those. It seems odd. But, you know, the younger you are, the more use there is for some of these new internet-enabled devices. And we worry about the security of them. Mm-hmm. Because these things, unlike your computers, affect the world in a direct physical manner. So what we're doing is we're giving the internet the capability to do things. If it's a medical device, if it's an automobile, to potentially kill people. And when I was talking before Congress, one of the things I said is that there's a fundamental difference between your spreadsheet crashes and you lose your data, and your car crashes and you lose your life. Mm-hmm. That even though it's the same computer, the same operating system, maybe even the same programs, the effects are night and day different. And we have to get used to a world where our computers can harm us. And I believe that's going to change everything.
Yeah, it would seem also you're telling companies that they have to prepare for a world where they have to be concerned about some of the risks in their products as they also have to be concerned about their bottom line.
And that's the way we work. I mean, if you build a product that can kill somebody, a medical device, a pharmaceutical, an airplane. There are different rules that we as society put around you. There are rules about licensing, about certifications, I mean, lots of different government standards because what you're making is dangerous. And in computers, we've been used to decades of you can do whatever you want because it didn't really matter. Because no, you know, as bad as things could be, nobody's dying. And that's changing. So I think companies will have different rules as producers and then also as consumers of these devices, because now they're also going to be worried about the effects of the thermostats in there that they are buying. About a couple months ago, there was a big attack against networks in, I believe, Finland, which affected computer-controlled thermostats in that country, which could mean burst pipes and property damage. Right? That just wasn't possible 5 years ago.
And, of course, the big device is smartphones. And there was a big debate this past year between the FBI and Apple over one of the smartphones used by the terrorists in the San Bernardino attacks, getting access to that data. You've written that going forward, you expect a renewed call from the FBI for backdoors into people's smartphones. What does that entail exactly?
Well, it's unfortunate, and this really has to do with the FBI's myopic view of the world. They are in charge of solving crimes. So they want things to be easier for solving crimes. They're not going to take a broader view. And in the San Bernardino case, they wanted Apple to basically make every phone they sell less secure so they would be able to break into the phones of suspected criminals. Now, that is a trade-off that we as society have to make. I mean, do we want the phones that our, I don't know, people who run our nuclear power plants, our congressmen, do we want those phones to be less secure in order to make a particular FBI forensic technique easier? I would like us to recognize that a secure phone is vital for our national security and that the FBI needs other tools for crime prevention, detection, for forensics, than breaking into a phone. Now, the bigger picture is the phone we all carry is an enormous surveillance device. Mm-hmm. It knows where we all are because it can't ring unless it knows where we are. It knows who we talk to. It knows our messages. It knows our emails, our contacts, our calendar. If you think about what's in our phone, they are incredibly intimate surveillance devices. And we've put them in everybody's hands, you know, for valid business reasons, but now you have the easy makings of a totalitarian state. Mm-hmm. And countries like China are using all of this to increase tyranny.
So, in the last minute and a half we have left here, I'm wondering, what are the major recommendations you would give to someone to try to protect their data and their privacy in this age of ubiquitous devices and possible foreign state interference?
Yeah, and this is a problem. There's not a lot you can do because most of your data is not in your hands. 10 years ago, I could tell you to protect your computer. But now, your email is on Gmail, your photos are on some photo site, your documents are in the cloud, everything is elsewhere. You might be using Yahoo, which just had an enormous data breach, and you just had your data there. I mean, a lot of it is we need to agitate for better laws and better systems because we've built a tech system where most of your security is not under your control. Right? That internet thermostat that I have in my home, I can't secure it. I mean, I have to trust the company that made it. Okay. So either I don't have it or I trust the companies.
Bruce Schneier, security analyst and fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Thanks again for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.